Turning now to the first letter of Peter, chapter 1, verse 13. 1 Peter, chapter 1, verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And our subject in a single study will be training for the Christian life, training ourselves for the Christian life, making sure we have the right attitude for the Christian life, training ourselves with regard to our thoughts and to our emotions. That's what the verse is really all about. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. It's an extraordinary verse to have in the first chapter of 1 Peter. If you look at the first verse of the chapter, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout, and then different places, regions, territories are listed. So it's a letter addressed to sufferers, to people who are strangers in the world and not of the world, and who suffer in many ways the consequences of that. In fact, the Apostle Peter refers to the manifold temptations, trials, the word means in this case, that they bear that cause great heaviness. And yet you find that in no time he's saying, gird up the loins of your mind. It seems a bit of rough handling. It seems that where you might expect the apostle to be gentle, he's quite firm and bracing and stirring. And that's interesting and significant. He doesn't leave this kind of exhortation to the end of the epistle. He comes in almost immediately with it. Wherefore, stir up the loins of your mind. And we'll come to this in a moment, but we live, as I often say, in a new culture. It isn't new to so many in this hall, because many are young, and the culture has come in by degrees, perhaps before you were born. But it is a new culture that we live in. One may learn the doctrines of the faith, having been saved, and rejoice in Christ, and yet still, to a marked degree, be living according to the new culture, and not realize. This is in many ways an intensely worldly culture, so far from the culture which is demanded by the Word of God, and which we're called to live in accordance with. Not only is it worldly, it's highly self-indulgent. It's the me, me, me culture that we live in. It's never been quite like it is now. And friends, even 50 years ago, when young people were thinking of career or anything like that, what they would do in their lives, even unregenerate, unconverted people, they wanted, or most of them, to do something useful. They wanted to play a part and make a contribution. And people would think along these lines. And that's almost vanished. Apart from among some Christians, there may be a few others, but people want to do what interests them, or what will make money and make them comfortable, or make them famous or rich or something like that. And so little do people seriously think, what ought I to do? How should I be progressing? Why should I study this simply because it interests me? That's just for me. That's not going to serve any useful purpose. Culture has changed enormously. You won't find that so much today. In fact, by many people, it would be regarded as ridiculous and foolish, naive to think in an unselfish way or about any contribution. So culture has changed massively. And, we've had this recent incident with a member of the royal family, according to the newspapers. The young man behaving scandalously. Now, nothing will happen to him. But certainly it's old history now, but when I was in national service, he would have been cashiered for that. That would have been regarded as an absolute scandal and dreadful and awful. And no matter what his position in society, if he was a royal, he may have been bundled out quietly. But if he was anything but a royal, he'd be court-martialed for that. Of course, we used to call it conduct unbecoming an officer. Well, we dropped that kind of language a long time ago. The Americans still use that, I believe. But now we call it scandalous conduct of an officer. And the penalty is to be dismissed, cashiered, in disgrace, that is. But nothing like that will happen today. That's ridiculous. Majority of people will probably stand up for him. This is the change in culture. But I can tell you, when I did my little 2 years national service, I know a number of incidents where people were thrown out and cashiered for far less than that. So times have changed dramatically. You don't have to set an example anymore. You don't have to live in a way that would avoid scandal and things of that kind. So this exhortation is going to help us tonight. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. It's all self-seeking and so much immorality and so much materialism, the culture of the soaps and the celebrity culture. Look at me, look at me. This is what counts, and I need hardly tell you all this. And of course, it's worse in personal attitudes and emotions. And this is where it may affect us. These things seep into us as Christians. We don't want it, we don't look for it, but as youngsters grow up, these attitudes seep into them as normal. And our task is to get rid of them, to advance and to leave all that behind. These are the things you hear said, and you could probably add to my list. It's my life. I can do what I like. It's my education. I study whatever I want. It's going to be my career. It's my ability, my gift. It's for me to do just whatever I please with it and to indulge myself. The basis of most of decisions today are, it interests me. I enjoy it. And that's the basis of selecting all sorts of things. Nothing more refined, nothing nobler than that. We don't want that to get into Christians, to get into us. My feelings must prevail. It's how I feel. This is the idea today. My feelings must be responded to. I have a right to my interests and feelings. I make decisions today, not speaking personally, I hope, because I like this. So that will determine my decision. Or I don't like this. It's all what I think. It's the determining factor. It's what I enjoy, as I've said. And then added to that, I want this soon. And I'm very frustrated if I have some objective and I can't have it soon because it pleases me. I have a right to be disgruntled and inflict my miseries on other people. I don't have any obligations, any social responsibilities, any responsibility to make anybody else happy or help them. I have a right to just exhibit however it is I feel. And then you hear this ghastly phrase constantly, somebody must be there for me. Whatever I go through, grief must come out. I have a right to weep on somebody's shoulder. It's necessary. I must speak about it. I must be comforted. Or if I've been hurt, I must be vindicated. I must have my pound of flesh. This is today's society. This is drilled into people. People are trained to think like this and to react like this and behave like this all the time. It's the exact opposite of godliness and spiritual conduct and holy conduct. And we don't want it seeping into us and affecting us and shaping us. That should be true of all of us. You can't help how you feel. You hear of people and they're married and they say, well, I love somebody else now. I don't love you anymore. As though they can't help that. And that's the end of it. And there's no duty, no responsibility, no feasibility of recovering love and obligation and affection and responsibility. Nothing like that in today's society. It's the do-nothing generation. Even in churches, so many churches, the pastors say, we can't get the young people to do anything. What a tragedy. to do nothing except please myself, indulge myself. I hope I'm not talking of us. I hope we see this rather as something that may affect us. It's a great danger. It may get into us, this spirit of the age, but we want to repel it. We want to keep it out. That's horrible and offensive to God and destructive of all spiritual advance and joy. So we have to talk about these things sometimes. I can only talk about things which excite the flesh. That's the attitude of some people, even if they don't articulate it. So enough of the present society. It's never been worse, friends. Even in ages before the Reformation, even in ages when the gospel hadn't penetrated lands, why, due to the social structures that existed, from the squire down to the serfs, certain things like this, the social systems forced certain duties and obligations upon you. Now all that's removed, and a good thing too. None of you are serfs, none of you are slaves, none of you are compelled to exercise respect and obedience to others who are above you. But now that that's the situation, we haven't put good conduct and social responsibility and unselfishness and kindness in its place. So we've got the worst situation that there has probably ever been in history in the Western world in these days. I don't think we can exaggerate it. We think today as though feelings, how we feel, feelings are inescapable and not blameworthy. They're unalterable. If I feel badly towards somebody, or hurt because I've been deprived of something, or I can't get something, it's not my fault if I feel bad about that. I indulge that feeling and keep it, and so on. That's terrible. We're like cars with no brakes at all, and a powerful engine that go completely out of control. So let's look at this text. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober. That is, the Greek implies, gird up the loins of your mind afresh. You've been taught how to do it before through conversion and the gospel. It's been an instinct to you to be in charge of your thoughts and your emotions by the help of God. But now gird them up. Peter doesn't seem too sympathetic, but he is really. These strangers who are not part of the world but are spread, have been dispersed through hostile and worldly regions. The first comfort he gives is gird up the loins of your mind. It's a wonderful illustration. The loose flowing robe. Tie it up. Tighten your belt so that you can get on without any impediments. And we don't want hindrances and impediments to ruin our communion with Christ and our spiritual progress. And so this text is about having purpose and intentions in our lives. It's a text really which says, your thoughts, pray and control them. Have aims and objectives and ideals. There's a Sunday school workers' meeting right after this Bible study. And may God's blessing be with all those who gather for a briefing for the new school year and the coming term. What an objective! It's not for us as Christians to be overwhelmed by our circumstances, feeling sorry for ourselves, being swept along by worldly temptations and desires. What an objective to have the privilege and the responsibility of guiding so many young lives to the things of God. Some of them will be converted in the next months and years. Some of them will carry this message and these principles that you teach in their hearts for years, and then God will move. I was rereading not so long ago the life of John Newton. What was it kept that ex-slave trader, kept his heart and his conscience when he was living such an evil life, so selfish, so far from God? But there was something which kept intervening and moving his conscience. Why, it wasn't in his case a Sunday school, but it was his mother and the instruction she'd received at her knee Well, he had received from her, even when he was a small child. As an old man, he could still remember the blue Wedgwood tiles of the fireplace where he was instructed as a little child in the things of God. And the messages planted in the minds of the young may be used by God at any time in the coming years. And there will be countless youngsters that we will know nothing about who are brought to Jesus Christ. Some of them perhaps after lives of waywardness because of the work that was accomplished among children in inner South London through our Sunday schools. But what an objective for a person to be a teacher in such an enterprise, praying for their children, teaching them patiently, communicating the love of God to them. This is the way to live, friends. Gird up the loins of your minds. Forget the world, part from it. Make sure your thoughts are good thoughts, positive thoughts for God, useful thoughts. Your aim is in heaven. But we're going to go through some of the arguments of the Apostle Peter here. Conform yourself, he says, to better values. Don't yield to emotional or thought life anarchy. It's all in there. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober. Train your thoughts. Mortify wrong thoughts. Put them to death. Ration thinking on things that really are unproductive. Redirect your thoughts. This is the way to advance. Before I go into some detail, the great enemy these days is the television. Don't let that train your mind. Watch as little of it as you need to. The culture of television now is so corrupting and so damaging. Watch as little as you need to. Social networking, surfing the net, too much socializing even among the young. Sometimes there's too much time spent in the company of others so that you don't do any independent thinking, reflecting, planning, deepening of yourself. These things are so important. You're in charge. You must govern and order your thought life and your emotional life by the help of God. Look back at the text again. Verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober. Now, the Apostle Peter doesn't mean that literally. In the context, he's talking about drunkenness in the thought life, drunkenness in the emotional life. He uses the language of abstention from alcohol, but he clearly means it to be applied in context to the subject he's speaking of. So don't just let your thinking be like a drunk man staggering down the road, lurching first to one side, lurching to the other, never in control of your thoughts, never determining what you're going to reflect on or for how long, never applying your mind to greater things and nobler things, and to things you need to scheme and plan and do in the service of Christ and for his name's sake, never applying your mind to the people you may have the opportunity to witness to and how you'll approach it and what you'll say to them and praying for that. These minds of ours are to be employed and harnessed in the service of the Lord, not just reeling about, absorbing anything that is hurled at us. No, nor drunk in our emotional lives, just letting our emotions run away with us and all over the place. And may I say, while I'm speaking of this, a little bit about music. And I'm talking now about not music in worship, but music we listen to personally. Music is a wonderful and remarkable phenomenon. You think of the beauty that God has left in nature, even in this fallen world. Amazing things that can be looked at and appreciated, which impart an atmosphere of their own and are compelling in their effect. And then you think of beauty in sound and the power of music, its potential beauty, its power to quieten the spirit, its power to stir the spirit, its power to impart immense pleasure, its power to secure memory associations, What a wonderful and extraordinary thing is music. Of course, there are dangers. You can become dependent upon it. There are people who've made that mistake because of its beauty. Music can be turned into maudlin sentimentality. That's what some churches do. They move from crashing rock to maudlin sentimentality. And if you just play sentimental tunes and so on, you can't really think. You can't attach those to thoughts and sentiments that are deep and profound and worshipful. And then there's the other extreme, and even in private use, the crashing rhythms. That kind of thing is mentioned in Isaiah 5. One of the great woes of Isaiah 5, woe unto them that rise up early in the morning, that they may follow strong drink, that continue until night, till wine inflame them, and the harp and the viol, the tabret and pipe and wine in their feasts, but they regard not the work of the Lord, neither consider the operation of his hands. There's nothing wrong with a harp, but when you get a harp connected with a viol, which is a kind of lyre, which is plucked by a piece of specially shaped bone, it's strictly a percussion version of a lyre. The tabret, which is a very cross between a kind of castanet and gadget of that kind, and a tambourine, mixture of the two, and the pipe and wine, the whole picture is of something intensely rhythmic. As drums are not mentioned, you might think it couldn't be too noisy. But, oh yes, it can be. You've only got to hear what the Spanish flamenco artists can do with sets of castanets, and it can be deafening and crashing and so. And rhythmic sound is, of course, hypnotic. These heavy rhythms and crashing sound, they bring about an altered state of consciousness. They are hypnotic. They are euphoric, too. And you're subjecting yourself to a kind of mind drug. You can't think intelligently, and it wrecks your tastes, distorts your thoughts, weakens your tastes. That's the, apart from its associations, because it's the product of the world, and it's usually associated with disgusting lyrics, it can't be adapted or used or employed by us. And yet, even some Christian youngsters, they become dependent upon it. This form of drug they need desperately. They must have it. The iPod must never be out. That's foolishness, friends. You can't gird up the loin of your mind. You can't develop and deepen as a person. You can't stretch beyond very small horizons with that going on and your addiction to that. It's the devil's trap. It's designed to make people incoherent and unthinking and dependent and pleasure-based, quite apart from the immoral associations. But what I'd like to take you through is this. Look at verse 13, the very first word. Wherefore gird up the loins of your mind. And that tells us that verse 13 is a conclusion drawn from the 12 verses that have gone before. So we need to look at those, because here in the whole passage is the counsel to us as to what to do with our thoughts and with our emotions. But before we look back to the beginning of the chapter, verse 13, wherefore gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you. In other words, you live your lives in the context of your pilgrimage and your eternal destiny. What has this got to do with my calling as a child of God and my eternal destiny, what I am listening to, what I am doing, what I am allowing to govern and shape me? What's it got to do with this? Hope to the end. Have a pilgrimage mentality. Anticipate glory. So you have the wherefore there. So before that, there are counsels for patience and for handling situations and not letting your emotions just blow you along. So I go back to verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers We could say sufferers, though it is strangers, people who are dispossessed, dispersed, cut off, not recognized, not accepted, scattered throughout the different regions, and they're learning to live with their situation. So how can they gird up and the loins of their minds? Reflection number one, verse 2. Elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. What a way to think. Elect people according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. What a privilege is yours, dear friend. You are known to God. And you have been known to God from before the foundation of the world. You're a beneficiary of the atoning death of Christ and of grace and peace. Look at the verse as Peter reminds them. Elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through sanctification of the Spirit unto obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. Grace unto you and peace be multiplied. When we feel down, just look at a verse like that. A whole list of privileges that we have. How indebted we are to live for God, to control our thought lives and our emotions. And then verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Here's the attitude of the Christian. Which according to his abundant mercy hath begotten us again unto a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. What a verse that is. Born again by the Spirit of God, through Christ and his atoning blood shed for sinners, and through his resurrection, a child of the resurrection of Christ, certain to live eternally. What privileges are ours? Can we not control ourselves? After every verse, we should really read verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. The conclusion. With verse 3 in mind, can we not do that? Verse 4, to an inheritance, incorruptible and undefiled, an inheritance, a heavenly hereafter, which is perfect, with no taint, no spot, and that fadeth not away. We'll never get used to it. Its blessings and its wonders will never fade. Its pleasures will never die. Which that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. The note of the personal. Christ has built a place for each one of his people. And in the light of that, wherefore gird up the loins of your mind. Then another great privilege in verse 5. Who are kept by the power of God, through faith, unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. The salvation there refers not to conversion, but to the being transported into eternal glory and transformed in holiness and wonder, who are kept by the power of God. Well, we will be kept. We may fall, and this is not to encourage falling. We know that by God, by his power, even if he has to discipline us sorely, will bring us back, because we've not only been saved, but we've been saved securely for all eternity. And so the apostle is able to say, who are kept by the power of God. And again, we can go straight to verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, knowing that we are safe eternally. And then verse 6. Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations. Let's read trials, which is the sense there. And the meaning of the verse is that trials may be our calling. But not for long. Look, it's all there in the verse. Though now for a season, only for a time. Here for a season, then above. If need be, ye are in heaviness, dispirited and under pressure, through all kinds of manifold. Doesn't just mean many, it means all kinds of many different forms of trial. Yes, but the Apostle Peter implies that's your calling, and there's so much help for you. verse 7, that the trial of your faith, there's going to be a mighty spiritual purpose even in your burdens and trials. Lift up your head, he seems to say, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honour and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. We know that there are benefits arise from trials even now, not only for us, because we look to God and we prove his blessing and his help and his strength, but so often people around us, they take notes of the spiritual resources we have in trials and the help that we seem to have, the divine help. And they say to themselves, if I went through that, I would go to pieces. This proves to me that that person has a walk with God and knows him and has his blessing. And it may often lead to the conversion of another soul. But in the last day, Christ will be vindicated because of all the things that he saw his people through. And then verse 8, whom having not seen ye love, we're buoyed up by our love for him. We haven't seen him, but we've proved him in all that he's done in our lives, in our hearts, in changing us, in all that we've tasted of communion with him, in all the answers to prayer that we've had, whom having not seen, not yet, ye love, in whom, though now ye see him not, yet believing, ye rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. You've had such uplifting experiences through God's dealings with you, when his power and blessing has been unmistakable. Look, just read on verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. You've got so much evidence of his goodness. Then he goes on in verse 9, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. Having offered us that comfort before, he proceeds in verse 10, of which salvation, now this is quite different, of which salvation, the resurrection body, the ushering into eternity, the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you. How interesting. A different point. The Apostle Peter is saying, look, you are blessed with far greater light than the prophets. You read Isaiah, those mighty statements, those soaring passages, those amazing prophecies that have been so accurately fulfilled. You all know Isaiah 53 and the prophecy of Calvary. Every detail is there. 700 years before, it's spelled out so perfectly. And yet, says Peter, you know more than the inspired prophets of old, because you look back on it. These things have been enacted and accomplished. You have the details. You're Christian people. You walk in clear light. If you'd lived in Old Testament days, you'd have needed more faith, because you had to trust that God would do one day some wonderful, mysterious thing that would take away sin, and trust in something you didn't know how. You didn't know what shape or form. But you trusted in the mercy of God and the promises and the types and the shadows of the Old Testament worship. But look what you've got, says Peter. You've got broad daylight, radiant sunshine. The doctrines are clear. The way of salvation has taken place. And you look back on it. That's what's in verse 10. Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently. They looked at their own prophecies. And they prayed and strove to understand. And you know it all. And you've seen it. So we can read verse 13 in the light of that. Wherefore gird up the loins of your mind. Verse 13 follows every verse of the 12 that precedes it. And then verse 11. This is what they were doing, the prophets. Searching what? Or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify, when they would ask. Once Isaiah came, and you had not exactly a detailed outline of Calvary, but a series of hints of an atoning death, then the prophets would say, yes, but when? Isaiah, is there any clue in your prophecy? Once the prophecy was given, the prophets were like ordinary men, except that they were very erudite men and spiritual men of great spiritual stature. But nevertheless, once the prophecy was given, they were like us. They sat down with their manuscripts and they looked intently. Have I missed something? This was given to me. But is there any clue of the timing when Christ would come, Messiah would act, and just precisely what form it would take? And we're told they studied so diligently. But what they were told was verse 12, unto whom it was revealed. And we know the passages that tell them this, that not unto themselves, but unto us, they did minister the things which are now preached unto you by them that preach the gospel unto you. We know so much more than they did. And they were told by God, close the book until the time appointed. That is all I am revealing for the moment. It is for a subsequent generation that these privileges will be more clearly unfolded. That's you, says Peter. You are the privileged people. In the light of that, verse 13, gird up the loins of your mind. It is astonishing, blessed with so much greater light. In fact, I can go on to verse 14, because it's the same theme. As obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance. No more tempers, unnecessary tears. Of course there'll be tears. Unnecessary tears, selfish tears, self-indulgent tears, sulks, self-pityings, ungoverned feelings, focus on appearances. No more of that, Peter says. Not fashioning yourselves according to the pre-conversion lusts in your ignorance, but as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation. Well, behavior. What a passage it is, and how full of help to us. I'm going to come to conclusion with verse 17. And if ye call on the Father, who without respect of persons judgeth according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here, your dwelling here, in fear. What kind of fear? Reverence and carefulness is in mind here. In reverence and carefulness. In other words, be scared of falling. And you will fall, not from grace, but into backsliding and sin. You will fall if you never govern your thoughts and your feelings and bring them into submission to the rule of Christ and focus them on things for him, not just pleasure and self. Let this world dictate how you think and feel. You will fall. But no, verse 17 effectively says, be scared of falling. Be scared of fruitlessness, that you never did anything for the Lord, that you never had a place in the work of God. Be scared of letting him down and letting the gospel down. In that sense, fear. If ye call on the Father, who without respect of persons judgeth according to every man's work, pass the time of your living here in fear and reverence and carefulness. I've known this several times, but I think of some young men over the years, the many years, who have even wanted to serve in the ministry. And yet, they said, in the end, that they spent far too much time in front of the television. They were addicted to it. They never dealt with their thoughts They never disciplined their conduct and their lives. I can think of some, they never had any service for the Lord. They were all over the place. The belt undone, the flowing robe of antiquity, hanging down, tripping them up. They were like drunken people in their thought lives. Oh, I must watch this, I must do this. I'm not gathering it all in. I must serve the Lord. I must contain my thoughts, my temptations, my desires. I must recognize all that's sick in this present culture and desire to be conformed to the things of the Lord. What a tragedy to be driven only by what you enjoy. I hope I haven't spoken too firmly, and I hope I haven't been offensive to you, but dear friends, these are real dangers for every one of us, so we need to be so careful that our thoughts and our emotions are controlled and governed and directed by the help of God and for His glory. Let's close this evening singing the hymn.